This is a KNKX special report. Tonight, KNKX Connects to Port Angeles. We'll hear how a housing shortage and the growth of tourism are both affecting the region. We'll also learn about the importance of a longhouse on the campus of Peninsula College, from the button blanket on display to the drum that hangs on the wall.
I've been told that if you're here and you hear it pinging, wants you to pick it up and play it.
We'll meet rescuers on either side of the U.S.-Canada border.
You know, in the case of the water here, people can easily be lost.
And we'll listen back to some moments from our broadcast of All Things Considered in front of a live audience last week at the Port Angeles Public Library, where we met a librarian who records oral histories along the North Olympic Peninsula.
I grew up in Squim. I graduated from Squim High School and then left and returned to the area just a few years ago. It's really a treat for me to collect these interviews.
That and more over the next hour. Good evening. I'm Ed Ronco. We're spending some time in Port Angeles this evening. It is the first stop on our KNKX Connects project. We're deepening our long-standing commitment to regional news here at KNKX. And in the months ahead, you'll hear more reporting from all over Western Washington. One of the biggest issues we found people concerned about in Port Angeles was housing. And so that is where we begin tonight. Port Angeles sits in a rural area along US 101, the main artery to the Washington coast. Away from the sudden growth of Seattle and Tacoma, you might think it would be easy to find a place to live. And you'd be wrong. The North Olympic Peninsula is experiencing a serious housing crisis. So much so that in May, the Port Angeles City Council voted to review the idea of letting people live in RVs and park trailers. The Peninsula Daily News reported that it was contentious, with the issue passing 4-3. So right now, let's look at the issue of housing. First, we meet Kay Cassinger. She runs the Peninsula Housing Authority, which provides a variety of services for people in need of housing. Rent subsidies, vouchers for housing in the community, public housing facilities the agency runs itself. Recently, they tore down some old housing from the 1940s and are building on that land. And when the project is done, they will have 63 new places to live instead of the 33 units that were there before. We head outside to take a look. Cassinger and I are staring at a big construction site. It's about 18 acres.
All of the buildings are going to face the streets that they're on to give them more of a cityscape. Townhouses, some flats.
Besides increasing the density, Cassinger says it's important to make the place feel like a neighborhood where people want to be.
We really believe that home is not just a house. It's a feeling, it's a relationship with your community and your neighborhood. While I'm sure there are people in the community that don't believe in what we're doing, most of them do. And they appreciate the fact that we involved them in this process for 2 years before we even got the master plan approved by the city.
Among the Peninsula Housing Authority's programs is one through USDA Rural Development, where families finance land and materials and then build their own homes, sometimes with as many as 10 households building at the same time.
Nobody moves in until everybody's house is finished. And that's probably one of the most emotional things I've ever participated in, is handing them their final building permit, their plans, and the key to their house.
How do they
You get all kinds. You get the kids that are just jumping up and down excited. You get mom and dad crying. They've got their parents there.
Because for them it must be the easing of a burden?
Well, it's a lifelong dream to be a homeowner for many people. And without that program, they wouldn't be a homeowner. Because it's designed... Their sweat equity is used for their down payment.
Cassinger says for all the programs they have to help people find housing, the need is still acute. Peninsula Housing Authority has waiting lists for all the properties it runs, and the average wait is between 12 and 18 months. Housing vouchers, in particular, operate on a lottery system that draws names only every 2 years. That is a long time. But before the lottery system, it took almost 6 years to go through the waiting list. Cassinger says housing in Port Angeles is often hindered by regulations, a one-size-fits-all approach that might make sense along the I-5 corridor, but not always along the Olympic Peninsula. And she says the housing shortage does not just affect people with low incomes. Cassinger says a lot of builders don't see mid-range and rental housing as a good investment.
You can find builders willing to build custom-spec homes because there's enough profit.
So if I have a lot of money and I buy my tract of land, especially just outside the city, I can build my dream house. Mm-hmm. But if I'm moving here on a, working wage...
$30,000 a year, $40,000 a year, $50,000 a year, you're going to have a hard time finding a house you can buy.
It's becoming a big challenge.
That's Eric Lewis, CEO of Olympic Medical Center, the health system whose main hospital sits near downtown Port Angeles. It's Clallam County's largest employer, more than 1,400 people. But right now they have 95 or so job openings because recruiting here is hard.
We've had two people that we've hired, one from California and I think one from the Puget Sound, that accepted jobs and then tried to find a place to live. And they could not find a place to live, so they had to tell us, sorry, I can't come work for you because there's no place to live.
How do you receive that news? What happens when you feel...
Shock.
Say that again, I'm sorry.
Shock, because it's never happened before, right?
Are you playing a role in solving the housing problem here then?
Not yet, but it's starting to cross our mind. I mean, there's a hospital I know on in the San Juan Islands, so they've actually built housing for their lower paid workers, but we haven't directly got involved. I will say we're giving signing bonuses to people. You know, we might give a $5,000 signing bonuses so they can take that money and help them find a place to live.
People we talk to in Port Angeles cite a variety of reasons for the housing shortage: a growing population, the cost of building, and more profit in larger properties outside the city limits rather than apartment buildings inside the city. But they also said the problem is not unique to Port Angeles. There's a report called the First Time Housing Affordability Index, put together by researchers at the University of Washington, and it shows that in the last few years, housing affordability has become worse in all but one of Washington's 39 counties, Whitman County, home to Washington State University. We're going to go now to the campus of another college, Peninsula College, in Port Angeles. And this is where you'll find a native longhouse. And when it was built 10 years ago, the longhouse was the first on a community college campus anywhere in the United States. Six Olympic Peninsula tribes worked with the college to create it, each of them contributing elements to the design. 88.5's Jeffrey Reddick got a tour of the longhouse from Sadie Crow.
Sadie Crow is the longhouse coordinator. She's worked there about 5 years. Half the time the longhouse has existed, though its roots stretch much further into the past.
Here at Peninsula College, we honor and recognize that we are on traditional Clallam and Sklallam lands, and the name of this building in the traditional language is Akustinaut, which means house of learning. It's a place where we share our cultures, our traditions, our identities, the things that make us unique.
When I visited, they were sharing a retrospective exhibit displaying the work of artists they've hosted over the last decade. Crow showed me some of those pieces.
I was able to work with multiple artists and in so many different mediums, like the traditional basket weaving. We have this miniaturized spearhead holder from Pam Morgenroth of the Quileute tribe, all the way to Lindley Logan's floral cube, which is a really cool blend of a traditional design in this contemporary form. And then as you walk through the art gallery, we come into our great room. This houses our permanent artwork. A traditional longhouse would have a dirt floor. We obviously can't have that here, but we have this beautiful polished concrete to look like that. A traditional longhouse would have a fire pit in the center. As you can see, we have a skylight that shines light down where that fire pit would be. The traditional benches, and it's amazing to me during our events when people will come in and they'll avoid the hard wooden seats with the tables, the very Western feel, and they'll sit on the benches with their back against these giant red cedar planks and feel part of the building on them.
Crow says she and others work to keep the longhouse connected to the community outside of the Peninsula College campus. They work with the Elwha Clallam Heritage Center and the Port Angeles School District. Jamie Valadez, who teaches Clallam language classes at the high school, brings her students to the longhouse for an annual Native American culture fair. Sadie Crow says it's a bit like a science fair.
With the trifold cardboard brochures, but it would be on culture, traditional foods, regalia, language, art. And we opened it up to the community and had an amazing response. Like, people want to know more about the culture here. So what came as a result of that at our first annual culture fair is this button blanket. students from the high school and the middle school would bus over here, and they designed and sewed this beautiful button blanket.
The blanket is almost as tall as a person, so that it can be draped over the shoulders. In the center, there's an eagle feather, surrounded by a large field of black, bordered by red cloth and buttons.
And it's been amazing since then to be able to see these students visit with their family and be like, look, I did that. That is a part of me and us, and it's on display in the longhouse. And right next to it, actually, is our house drum. So this was done by the artist Roger Fernandez from the Lower Oaklalam tribe. He's one of those artists that we consult with and seek guidance on in many aspects of our programming. And I've been told that if you're here and you hear it pinging, it wants you to pick it up and play it. And it gets used, and it's lovely when people come in and pick it up and share a song and celebrate.
Crow says the building is meant to encourage spontaneous celebration, or study, or contemplation.
There's a piece about it that I think is different than any other building. It's not just a building, you know, it's a sacred place.
Sadie Crow is the Longhouse Coordinator at Peninsula College. You can hear more about the Clallam language classes that were mentioned in that piece at Port Angeles, the classes that take place at Port Angeles High School. That's on our website, knkx.org. David Jones has also been at Peninsula College for a decade. Right now, we're listening to one of his compositions. Jones is head of the music department. He leads the college's jazz ensemble. He is a prolific composer and arranger, writing hundreds of tunes that have been performed all over the world. And he was born in Seattle, and he keeps in touch with his musician friends there. Jones talked about arranging a piece for the Seattle band Jazz Police and finding inspiration in the classical composition My Native Land by Edvard Grieg.
It sounded very soulful. That's the A section, and there's the second theme. It just always captured me. So I made it into a piece for big band, and I felt like it was a way of honoring my classical background and honoring the whole third stream concept. The notes that Grieg wrote, so it comes from his music. The second theme I changed to the brass. So far, it's like a very straight kind of ballad. No drums or bass or anything. And then right about here, I bring in the rhythm section. And that's Al Keith playing over the second theme there. Stretching the chords a little bit too. Give him a little bit more room to play. ¶¶ There's Greg on alto. Kind of playing off the melody a little bit, but going his own way.
That's Native Land, performed by the Seattle Group Jazz Police and arranged by David Jones, the head of the music department at Peninsula College. Jones says classical music and jazz have been connected since the 1920s, when Jelly Roll Morton wrote Dead Man's Blues, borrowing elements of Chopin's Funeral March. There's more with David Jones on our website, knkx.org. Right now, we're going to talk a little bit about tourism. Port Angeles sits at the entrance to Olympic National Park. It draws millions of visitors each year. And before we get to the economic impact of that, we thought we'd just spend a little time in the woods. 88.5's Jeffrey Reddick took us up the Lake Angeles Trail. Emphasis on up.
I'm on the Lake Angeles Trail. I've just crossed a footbridge over a little creek. But this is just the beginning of the hike, so let's keep moving. That immediate vertical climb from the little footbridge across the creek is the theme of the hike so far. Turns out topo lines on a map have real-world consequences. Whew. Here I am now at Ennis Creek. Below the trail, a series of rapids and pools. So I'm looking at the second footbridge and the white water rushing down. And here we are at Lake Angeles. The water is perfectly clear. There's a small island, and then beyond that, the craggy peaks covered in snow, jagged against the clouds. I should say that when the trail levels out, there is a small pond, and after all that climbing, it's a little heartbreaking when you first glimpse it. Oh, is that the lake? Do not despair. Continue on. It's just a few hundred feet past that you find this incredible view.
A walk in Olympic National Park with 88.5's Jeffrey Reddick. The park is the biggest tourism draw to this region, nearly 3.5 million visitors last year. But for the individual communities on the peninsula, Port Angeles and Squim and Port Townsend and Forks and beyond, visitors are an increasingly important part of the economy. One of the people who tries to bring them in is Marcia Massey. She is executive director of the Olympic Peninsula Visitor Bureau, which promotes destinations in Clallam, Jefferson, and Mason counties. She says people seek out this region now, but not too long ago, that wasn't the case.
There were days when we used to go to various trade shows and things, and we would constantly be having to say, explain to people that when we said we were from Washington, no, it was not, you know, the home of the White House and the Jefferson Memorial. And it sounds silly now, but it's been in my professional career where we spent a lot of time explaining which Washington. And now I think Washington, Oregon, British Columbia, that whole sort of Pacific Northwest area has really come into its own. Seattle reports, and I would say that we probably mirror this somewhat, that international visitors tend to be probably less than 10% of our total visitors, but they're about 16% of the spending. But the other part of our market segment, if you will, is the growing population of Puget Sound. So when you think that the greater Seattle area is growing at, what, net 20,000 a year, something like that, most of those people are coming from other places. And if you're in an office building in Seattle or any place downtown or in that area and you look west, we have the world's biggest billboard sitting there saying, come, it's those gorgeous Olympic Mountains.
It has struck me more than once that I am now sitting in the middle of the things that I sigh at from Ballard.
Right, right. And if you ever walk along Shoal Shoal, or if you're up at Sunset Park, or if you're in a high-rise downtown Seattle and you look west, you're looking across at these magnificent mountains, and I think anyone moving here would be, what's out there? What is that? I want to go see that.
When we look around here at the communities that make up the Olympic Peninsula, How much do they depend on the visitor industry?
Tourism has continued to grow, and one of the ways we look at that impact is visitor spending and the tax revenues generated by visitor spending. In 2017, visitor spending was $432 million. But if we drill down and look at the taxes that that generated, so just the visitor spending, the taxes, the local taxes, not including state taxes, the local taxes generated was $9 million. And those are the taxes that go for schools and fire and parks and other services that we as residents depend on. There are some research here in Washington State that says, in essence, visitor spending offsets our individual taxes by $450 per household a year.
Do you partake in any of the things you promote? Are there favorite activities or destinations of yours?
Oh, gosh. It's hard to have favorite children, you know, when you live in an area like this. I frequently go up to Hurricane Ridge. I love, in the summer, with the National Park Service, they do a night sky program. So you can go up to the top of Hurricane Ridge in the dark, and there are full moon hikes, and there is also a night sky program, which is just awesome. I mean, you just feel like you could reach out and touch those stars. It's fantastic. I'm a beach girl, so I'm always looking for any opportunity to get to Rialto Beach, hiking out to Hole in the Wall or Ruby Beach. I love to go whale watching. I never get tired of going whale watching.
You've given a nod to the whole family. There will be no jealous siblings out there.
Well, you know, this is a really personal place for me. I did not grow up here. I'm not from Port Angeles like many are here. But when I was 20 years old, I moved from the East Coast to the West Coast to go to the University of Washington. And 3 months later, my new friends said, okay, it's spring break. We're going camping at Cape Alava. And I said, okay, sure. You know, I had no clue where Cape Alava was. Didn't know, but, you know, you're 20 years old and you got new friends. And so you go, great, let's go. And that was a long time ago. But I can tell you it was such an incredible experience, such an otherworldly experience for a young woman, you know, who grew up on the East Coast. I've never forgotten it. So I have long ties here with the Olympic Peninsula.
It grabbed you.
It grabbed me and held on.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be able to talk about this great destination.
Marcia Massey, Executive Director of the Olympic Peninsula Visitor Bureau, serving Clallam, Jefferson, and Mason counties. You're listening to 88.5 KNKX. I'm Ed Ronco, and this is a special presentation tonight. KNKX connects to Port Angeles. A lot of what we're sharing with you comes from a special broadcast we did on Thursday from the Port Angeles Public Library in front of a live audience. We shared stories from around the region, but it turns out the North Olympic Library System has a storytelling program of its own. It is an oral history project. It's called Listen Up, and we spoke about the project with librarian Danielle Lepping.
The program's focus really is collecting and archiving oral histories from Clallam County residents. And it got started in that Knowles had applied for the StoryCorps at Your Library grant a few years back, and we weren't awarded the grant. However, we had the recording equipment, and so we wanted to do a similar StoryCorps-type program where we could record residents' stories.
How many of these interviews have you done now?
So we started with a national park theme where we collected 16 interviews, and then we did a veterans theme collecting 11 interviews, and then a community theme last year, and we got 13 interviews. This year we're doing a theme on what I like to call library love. So we're trying to collect stories about folks' library experiences, wanting them to share what a library means to them or their favorite memory of any library or Knowles Library or what their earliest memory of visiting a library is.
And there's a station over to our left from where we're sitting where you can listen to the stories that have been recorded.
Yep,
so
we
far.
Created an iPad listening station so that anybody can walk over and put the headphones on and then pick out an interview and listen to it from there.
And if people want to participate and record their own story, they can come here and do that.
Yep, they can contact the library. You can send an email to listenup@knowles.org. There's information online at the website, knowles.org, and then we'll also have designated recording days throughout the summer.
So we were listening to some of these clips, and I heard one story from a woman who was serving aboard the USS Carl Vinson on 9/11, when 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. Let's listen now to just a little bit of her.
We couldn't send any emails out. We couldn't bring in any emails. So basically, we were floating at sea. The only thing that we were getting were satellite images. We did not know what was going on.
That's just one. That's an amazing example of what you're doing here.
Mm-hmm.
As, you know, these moments in people's lives. When you listen to these, as you're working on this project, you know, what do you take away? What do you learn from listening to all these stories that people record?
I think it's just been a different way for me to help connect with the community. I grew up in Sequim. I graduated from Sequim High School and then left and returned to the area just a few years ago. And so it's really helped me just further connect and appreciate the area that I'm in. And also, it's been really fun to hear people's national park experiences. It's been really interesting to hear veterans' experiences. I mean, it's really a treat for me to collect these interviews.
And to be able to just kind of sit with people and reflect on
yeah,
the things that happened to them.
Yeah, it's very intimate, and it's really enjoyable.
Danielle Lepping, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Danielle Lepping, a librarian with the North Olympic Library System based in Port Angeles. The oral histories recorded as part of the Listen Up project are available online. You can hear them at knowles.org/listenup. That's knowles.org/listenup. So let's talk a little now about some history and the future, specifically the history and future of some land just north of Sequim. That's where you'll find Nash Huber. He came here in 1968. He is the co-founder of the year-round Port Angeles Farmers Market, which has been in business since 1980. And he's considered to be a pioneer of the organic farming movement in the Northwest. 88.5 Environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe met up with Nash Huber on his farm in the Sequim Dungeness Valley.
On a recent sunny morning, I find Nash Huber tinkering with a brush hog mower near several rows of his greenhouses.
I'm not a great mechanic, but that's about what we have right now because the real mechanics are out driving tractors.
He says tinkering with food is his favorite task on the farm. He's known for breeding new varieties of crops such as kale and spinach and for taking advantage of the rich soil and the microclimate that has allowed him to grow produce year-round on the Northern Olympic Peninsula. It shows up in organic markets all over the region. Nash Huber is developing a new kind of Brussels sprout and a new Romanesco cauliflower.
You know, food that tastes like food is real important to us. It's got to eat good. I do like taste. I do like flavor. It's a big deal.
That commitment to flavor, along with his early use of organic farming techniques, have earned him many awards over the years. Nash is 77 now. He's been farming the soil in Sequim without chemicals for the past 50 years. He was 27 when he left the Midwest, where he grew up on a small family farm. After college in the 1960s, he worked for a big food processing company, developing new methods for utilizing cornstarch.
I was a chemist, a food chemist. I took stuff apart, you know, and I put it back together. I was a carbohydrate protein chemist. I could do stuff that people hadn't done before. And it was interesting. It was challenging, beautiful, interesting work. I was turned on by it. But I could see where it was headed, and I didn't want to be part of that.
He enrolled in grad school, but he still wasn't happy.
Blew that up, you know, in 67, 68, with everybody else blowing stuff up. And just said, okay, that's it.
He decided to go west. He and his girlfriend at the time piled into a green Chevy 2 and drove, first to California. They went up the coast and eventually landed in Sequim. Nash remembers the moment he decided he wasn't leaving. He loved the clean air and open space, but it was something else that made him stay.
We'd come across the floating bridge over there over Hood Canal. Had been built in 64. And it cost a buck and a half then to cross the bridge, and I said, well, we're not going back. A dollar and a half was quite a bit more than it is now. And then came over that little rise there as you first come over the 101 and looking out. The sun was going down August evening and could see the sunset out over Sequim. And it was a much smaller town then. And it was absolutely stunningly beautiful. And seeing the mountains and the sun. And I said, well, yeah, we're not going back. This is it. We're staying here.
That spring, he rented 35 acres on Squim Bay. He grew hay on burnt-out fields and pieced his life together with ends barely meeting. He used the natural organic methods he learned from his parents as a kid on the farm in Illinois. To make money, he learned carpentry, worked for a while as a contractor building houses. He started growing vegetables for food, kept bees the way his grandfather had taught him, and co-founded the Port Angeles Farmers Market because he and some friends needed a place to sell their stuff.
You had to have income. You know, it takes money to live.
Eventually, he expanded his vegetable growing by leasing land in the mineral-rich Dungeness River Valley. And he met his wife, Patty McManus. She's his business partner on the farm, handling promotions and currently poultry and egg production. She greeted me in front of a grassy pen with dozens of free-range hens and several roosters.
Well, this is only maybe half the flock. The other half is in the barn. We're kind of a different operation.
They don't use any commercial feed. Instead, they give their hens a special mix of protein-rich grains, most of which they grow themselves.
Like here, this is a bin of our grain. We have a couple of different kinds of wheat. We have triticale. We have barley.
And they soak the chicken feed in whey left over from local cheesemakers. Patty says the chickens help control the bug population in a way that's beneficial to their food crops.
We don't want our fields insect-free. We want taconid flies and praying mantis and honeybees. Of course, we want bees. There's many different kinds of insects that will come in. Ladybugs is the famous one that eat aphids. We want those.
Their farm has grown. It covers about 700 acres now. Patty says Nash was instrumental in getting much of it protected from development. He worked with the PCC Farmland Trust to save the land he had come to love.
This was their first acquisition, the Delta Farm. You're standing on their land. And Nash went over there and said, this is the heart of Dungeness. If we don't save it, Dungeness will go to development.
Nowadays, the biggest challenge isn't so much saving the land, it's finding talent to keep working it without chemicals as Nash and Patty get older.
Hey, Piggy, Piggy, Piggy. Hey, girls.
They say right now the hope for the future seems to be a lot of
Piggy,
young
Piggy,
women
Piggy. Hey.
Who are stepping up, eager to do this work, like 23-year-old Andrea LaPlante, their livestock manager, who moved here after college on the East Coast. She's been farming since she was 13.
Yeah, I'd be harvesting tobacco and I'd see dead bugs on the plants, and when I was 13, I didn't know anything about organic agriculture, but I knew that that was wrong.
Nash hired her after finding her resume on the internet. Now she's in charge of pork production at the farm. Just beyond the barn with the chickens is a pen in an open field with several litters of piglets and the tired sows that are still nursing them.
It's really satisfying when I look out and I see them playing. That's how you know your animals are happy, that they aren't constantly eating and they have time to play with each other. And so because of that, I feel that they had a good life and I make sure they have a good death and I can also enjoy them after they are gone.
Explore the farm and you'll meet many other young women intent on learning from Nash. And he says he's learning from them too as he figures out how to delegate and communicate his legacy.
You know, if you can't pass stuff on, then it pretty much ends with you. I want to see the farm continue. I want to see the production system that Patty and I put together here continue. I want to see other people be able to utilize the land we've saved and the production system we've initiated to be able to expand it, grow good food that people can eat and be healthy on.
Nash says a lot has changed since he first started farming here 50 years ago. It's a lot more crowded, especially in the spring and summer times. But he says the growing population is also a growing market for his food, which more and more urban people are willing to pay a little extra for, whether they come to his farm stand in Squim or to one of the many farmers markets that carry his produce all around the region. Bellamy Palethorpe, 88.5 News.
And we just can't resist sharing one more piece of audio with you from Nash Huber's farm. It was something that we did not quite have time to fit into the original broadcast, because this story made us think of something attributed to the public radio legend Noah Adams. He says, you should always put chickens into your story because chickens are funny. Bellamy got that, as you heard. And he also said you needed a barking dog in there, too. Well, We got a bark, but it was not from a dog.
Oh, that scared me.
That is, that's a sow who was not so politely indicating that neither she nor her piglets wished to be interviewed for the radio. Bellamy's fine right now, and we'll be back with more as 88.5 KNKX connects to Port Angeles and the North Olympic Peninsula. Among the many people who welcomed us to Port Angeles was the poet Tess Gallagher. She was born there in 1943, and she's lived there on and off ever since, in recent decades splitting time between the northwest of the United States and the northwest of Ireland. Tess's poems are full of people, family members, friends, acquaintances, experiences and conversations she has worked into the art. And she is not a distant observer shut away from the mess of humanity.
I want to feel connected. You know, I have to have solitude, obviously, in order to find the language I need to write anything. Your biggest element has to be solitude. I am a rather quiet person in that part of me that gets the work done. But the rest of me is very gregarious.
When the celebrated author Raymond Carver first came into Tess Gallagher's life, the balance shifted a little too much toward gregariousness instead of solitude. She was living at a house that she had designed in the 1970s. She calls it the Sky House, and it offers a stunning view of the Strait of Juan de Fuca.
Well, it turned out he didn't like the view. It was just too much going on. I mean, there were cargo ships and ferry boats and little fishermen's boats and... Oh, he just wouldn't get any work done, he said. And the eagles would fly, and there would come some seagulls and hummingbirds. And so I said, look, you're just going to have to cope. It is a beautiful view. Just go in there, put your nose down to your work, and do your stuff. You can have that side office, and I'll write up on the bed, on my lap, the way I've been living up until now. I'm pretty good at it. Working wherever I land. It turned out not to be a very good place for two writers because I didn't know this about Ray, that he was an awful gossip and that he would get onto the telephone and he would just roar with laughter at whatever grisly or funny story was being told to him. So you couldn't possibly get anything done. And so I then had to check out of my own house and go and get a motel room because we were working on a movie script and I couldn't concentrate. So Ray was very domestic. He couldn't stand being away from me for the night. So he would come up to the motel and then I would read him what I had done. And he would stay the night and then I'd kick him out in the morning.
That's the poet Tess Gallagher talking about the early days of her shared life with Raymond Carver. You can find much more with her, including recordings of her reading poetry, at knkx.org. She spoke with 88.5's Jeffrey Reddick. Earlier today, a boat crew from Coast Guard Station Port Angeles responded to a boat fire north of Protection Island. That's west of Port Townsend. The three people on board that vessel put on survival suits. They were rescued by a Good Samaritan. And the Coast Guard Station at Port Angeles responds frequently by boat and by air to mariners in distress or people in the water. But let's say you find yourself in trouble on the Canadian side of that invisible dotted line in the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Who's looking out for you then? 88.5 Simone Alisea went to Victoria to meet the Canadians who were there in an emergency.
There's a lot of movement in Victoria Harbor. Seaplanes, kayaks, and of course, the MV Coho from Port Angeles all seem to be coordinating effortlessly.
That's the Coho giving the signal that they're about to come around the corner.
Jackie Cowan is steering her small boat out of Fisherman's Wharf into the inner harbor, where I just see a bunch of water, boats, and the occasional buoy. She sees order.
This large ship has precedence because it's the largest vessel with the least ability to maneuver, right? So normally the plane would take priority, but as you see, it's turning and going off to the side.
Cowan is one of the people who comes when there's distress in Canadian waters. She's part of the Royal Canadian Marine Search and Rescue Station 35 in Victoria.
Are you in need of assistance?
Yes, we are.
Cowan and about 10 of her fellow crew members are doing a training exercise out in the harbor. They're practicing how to tow a broken-down vessel. The red and yellow rescue boat sidles up to us, and crew members in orange dry suits and life vests packed with gear start tying lines to our boat. Where they see a life-saving tool, I just see a bunch of rope.
So it's still pretty slack, eh?
Here's the thing. Everyone at Station 35 is a volunteer. Cowan runs a whale-watching business. Deputy station leader Dave Best owns a vanilla extract company.
It's always a struggle to keep people, you know, keep the station stood up, you know, keep people trained. You know, you lose people to jobs. They move across the country. They have wife and kids. And so it's hard to keep, maintain a full crew, but we managed to do it.
The Canadian Coast Guard isn't part of the military like it is in the States. The agency is still tasked with marine search and rescue, but the work is distributed a little differently. Station 35 is considered part of a Coast Guard auxiliary. They have to follow the agency's practices, and they're held to Coast Guard standards, but they aren't getting paid. For an island with no road access to the mainland, keeping people safe on the water is a pretty regular concern. There are more than 30 marine search and rescue stations in British Columbia.
We are pretty much 911 for the water. So, yeah, there's a lot of responsibility with that. There's a lot of people that rely on us.
Station 35 is responsible for a stretch of water from the harbor to the U.S. border in the middle of the strait. They have two boats, 18 full crew members, with about 40 people signed up to go through training. To put this in perspective, let's head across the border to Edie's Hook in Port Angeles. There, you can find a U.S. Coast Guard air station. Lieutenant Junior Grade Kelsey Smith is a search and rescue pilot. He explains several differences between the air station and Station 35 in Victoria. First, the air station covers a lot more water.
We're responsible for the entire area of Puget Sound, the Straits of Juan de Fuca, and all the way down to about La Push, I believe.
The number of pilots is about the same, 16 to 18, Smith says. But the Coast Guard outpost at Port Angeles has several boats, so the ultimate number of members who can respond to a call can vary.
I know that we have about 140 to 300 members, depending on if the boat's here or not, here at the station Port Angeles.
Another major difference is funding. In the U.S., it's our tax dollars that pay to help keep people safe on the water. Almost everything at Station 35 is funded through donations. They hold events like a dinner on the docks and an upcoming online auction with items donated by local businesses. Deputy Station Leader Dave Best says it adds up.
That boat you're looking at right there, we just got that delivered about 3 months ago now. That's $400,000, right? What I'm wearing right here is about $2,000 a gear. There's another $2,000 a gear.
But a lot of the same things did come up when I talked to the two agencies. How quickly the weather can turn. I also heard a lot about kayakers and, relatedly, the things casual boaters can do to keep themselves safe. That includes wearing the right gear and learning how to talk on the radio. Crew members told me learning those things was one of the biggest benefits to joining, one of the things that made it worth giving up many, many hours of their time. That and getting to drive some very fast boats. But I think there's more to the story. U.S. Coast Guard pilot Kelsey Smith back in Port Angeles has some insight.
Definitely, I think that just goes above and beyond and says a lot about that who they are. Because that's, you know, we have paid, we have time allotted to do this. This is our job. Whereas, you know, like you said, they're taking time out of their day to do this, and I think that really speaks a lot to their character.
We sit and float for a while in Victoria Harbor, Cowan's small whale-watching boat tied to the red and yellow rescue boat. As the sun sets, the volunteer crew tells me a story about how they worked with another Vancouver Island station to rescue 9 divers whose boat capsized.
You know, in the case of the water here, people can easily be lost. And it takes a whole bunch of people, a whole bunch of equipment, and a whole bunch of systems put in place to do everything they can do to find that person.
What I really, really do get an incredible amount of satisfaction from is that you actually do save lives.
The straits between Port Angeles and Victoria are assuredly safer having people like Cowan and Best and Smith in the air and on the water. But hopefully, you never run into them. Simone Alisea, 88.5 News.
We're going to finish tonight's broadcast talking about endings. In Port Angeles, there's a nonprofit hospice, and it does not charge patients or their insurance a penny. The reason that hospice exists is because of a nurse named Rose Crum, who is now 92 years old. 88.5's Will James met with her to look back on a career in which she's helped hundreds of her neighbors in Port Angeles live out their last days.
Rose Crum ended up in Port Angeles the way a lot of people do, by accident. She and her husband, Red, were on their way to start a new life in California when, you know, that thing happened.
We stopped to visit, and we never left.
That was 70 years ago. Rose was a nurse from Minnesota. Red had just gotten out of the military, serving in the South Pacific. Rose got a job at a hospital in town, and then in the late 70s, found herself at a nursing convention in Seattle. Part of the program was about this new thing called hospice, starting up back east, and it struck a chord with Rose. Almost 20 years earlier, she had cared for her father before he died. And that experience never left her, simply because they had talked about the fact that he was dying.
I was a nurse at that time, but I had never talked to any of my patients about their dying, and I had a lot of them die.
Rose decided to bring hospice back home to Port Angeles. At first, it was just her and another nurse volunteering their time. They faced resistance, especially from within the medical community, which viewed death as a failure or something to be ignored.
Many of the older doctors were very much against it. They called us the death squad. I said, we'll kill them with kindness. And we won the medical community over. But it was a slow process.
In those early days, Rose ran the hospice out of her house. She enlisted her kids to help move beds in and out of patients' homes. She still remembers her first patient. Rose had helped the woman give birth years earlier. She also remembers her first $50 donation. It came from a funeral home in town. That's where it all grew from.
When I think back on it now, there are parts of it that almost seem like a miracle. Because the odds were all against us, really.
Rose kept her notes on her patients on these little recipe cards. This aversion to paperwork is a theme of her career. It's the reason she fought to have her hospice remain independent when there was a push to have all hospices in the state licensed by Medicare. She didn't want the bureaucracy of having to bill Medicare or insurance or anyone for her services. She just wanted everything to stay free. And that's what she ended up arguing before state lawmakers.
I thought, here I am, a utility kitchen type of person, and I'm in Olympia testifying before these committees and fighting for the right to be an independent, free community hospice.
Rose won. To this day, the Volunteer Hospice of Clallam County remains one of the few unlicensed hospices in the country. It's a big reason why Betty Wood, who manages patient care for the hospice, wanted to work there.
Many times people will still call and make sure, are you Rose's hospice? So yes, it's that reputation of a group of people that want to assist someone and their family but not tell them what to do.
Rose retired when she was in her 80s. The hospice she founded now has 12 paid employees, dozens of volunteers, and takes care of more than 120 patients at a time. And that idea that families should be at the center of caring for a loved one who's dying, that's one of Rose's legacies.
We wanted the families to be in control of their situation so they would have that feeling of independence, and we would be just propping them up. There's a certain amount of healing in caring for someone because you've given all, your all, and it helps with the grieving.
Rose knows from experience. One of the hospice's early patients was her husband, Red. Rose says when he was dying of leukemia, he acted as if he had absorbed every word she ever said about hospice.
He died what I called the perfect death, if any death is perfect.
Red spent time alone with each of their 9 children before he died. For Rose, decades of meeting her neighbors at the most vulnerable point in their lives provided a model for how to live and, yes, how to die. But it's the example her husband left her that stands above them all.
He
He said as he was dying, "I'm not afraid. I've had a good life. I have no regrets." You can't beat that.
That's the thing. When Rose talks about Red's death, she sounds sad, but also kind of impressed.
Now, if I can die as well as he died, I'll be very happy. But I'll go out screaming and kicking. And
at the very least, she is not afraid to talk about it. Will James, 88.5 News.
We are so grateful to everyone in Port Angeles and the North Olympic Peninsula who took time out of their busy schedules to tell us about their communities and their lives. That'll do it for us tonight. We're going to be doing more of these. Do keep listening. Our news director is Aaron Hennessy. Our director of content is Matt Martinez. We had stories from Bellamy Palethorpe, Will James, and Simone Alisea. The program was produced by Jeffrey Reddick. I'm Ed Ronco.
Support for KNKX Connect comes from the Falconer family of Western Washington, supporters of a free, independent, and energetic press, who urge listeners to get involved in their local community and to support KNKX.
Hi, I'm Sissy Bruch. I am the mayor of Port Angeles, and this is your independent station, KNKX 88.5 Tacoma, Seattle, KPLI 90.1 Olympia, KVIX 89.3 Port Angeles, Victoria, KPLK 88.9 Cedro Woolley, streaming all jazz worldwide and jazz24.org, KNKX connects the Northwest with jazz, blues, and NPR news.
Even the dogs listen.
They do.